working as an artist, working in sound. I think about soil having a voice. Multiple voices contained within it. And Earth is a choir of these voices.
Scientists will tell you that it takes 1,000 years just to build 1 inch of soil. And so black gold is not a metaphor. It really is the most precious thing.
How does soil connect us to the past?
This process of taking some clay from the ground and making it into a pot, you're immediately, like, gesturally very, very close to somebody who was around 20,000 years ago.
Thinking about and looking at soil is a very complex and live ecosystem that feels like another body. How is the place speaking? Is it happy? Is it singing in the way that it should?
And what stories are embedded in the soil that need to be unearthed?
Soil for me is an archive. It is a tomb. It is a witness because it has seen so much. Yeah, and it's where I belong. This is where I belong, this soil.
In this series, we're looking at soil through the lens of art, launching off from the Somerset House exhibition, Soil, the world at our feet. In the last episode, we followed the journey of soil at the beginning of life. In this episode, we're looking at soil as a material, looking at how it connects us to difficult histories and the earliest forms of making. What can soil tell us about ourselves? What does it say about who we are and who we could be? We start with one of the earliest materials used by humanity, clay.
Clay has this vast amount of applications, some of which are visible and some of which are completely, literally, like, otherworldly, as in off-planet.
The history of humanity has been formed and shaped by clay, and not just pots.
It might be used as building materials, as pipes under the ground, on rocket noses for things going into space. There's clay on Mars, which has certain implications for what we know about Mars. It's tied into the history of writing, the history of sculpture and pottery, replacements for, like, knees and things like that.
Clay comes from the ground, usually where there was once water. It's made of minerals, plant life, and lots of tiny, tiny particles, much smaller than soil. As a grower, clay isn't generally something you would want because it doesn't drain water very well.
These are the bags of, like, foraged clay, I guess, that I've taken from various places. So this is from, Cornwall, and this one's from a skip outside.
Jennifer Lucy Allen is a writer, a ceramicist, and the author of Clay, A Human History.
Ooh, maybe I'll try and throw with it. I am wedging up the clay badly in a tiny, tiny corner. So this is probably, if you don't wedge it up properly, it has bubbles in it and you might hear them explode as I'm throwing.
We headed down to her little pottery studio at the end of her garden in London and fired up the wheel.
Shall I? So before you throw a pot, like, you have to get this clay into the centre. It looks easy, but it's, like, the hardest bit, really. If I tried to throw with this now, like this, it would be all wonky and might fall apart. The very first ceramic object that we have in the historical timeline is a figurine of a woman called the Venus of Dolní Vestinice, found in present-day Czechia. And she's amazing. She's like this incredibly beautifully sculpted figure of a woman with, like, huge, like, drooping breasts and this big muffin top and, like, this really big voluptuous ass. And so I got a lump of clay and tried to make a replica of this figurine, but the sculpting is amazing. Like, especially kind of this gorgeous, like, fleshy muffin top, you know. I really struggled to make it. I couldn't get this bum, like, rotund enough. There's something really amazing about trying to replicate something that somebody made 27,000 years ago and finding that you're, like, not a better sculptor than them.
I am going to try and make it a little bit finer, but it's got a bit of a wobble in it now, which means I should stop. That means it's off-centre, and every time the wheel turns, it's going to throw itself off-centre because that material wants to move.
There is something I find difficult to articulate that's really powerful about holding a figure of a woman that somebody also made 27,000 years ago in your hand. You have taken a piece of earth, you have sculpted it, you have formed it. It's very intimately connected to our, like, existence as human beings.
I'm just going to shave something off the base. Clean up my wheel head.
As we hold the clay figure in our hand, we see ourselves again in a new light.
The soil, I think, as a tomb, as a witness, as an archive.
Land isn't neutral, and neither is soil.
The soil as an archive is holding material remains that allows us a window into what happened here over the last, well, more than 400 years.
What ways does soil connect us to history? One of the artists in the Somerset House exhibition is Annalie Davis, an artist based in Barbados.
I make work that responds very much to the history of the plantation. I'm using my work to really try and understand and grapple with that long, complicated history.
Annalie's work spans tapestry, sculpture, planting and activism. She sees her work as an intervention into the soil, as a way of responding to the trauma of the site and hopefully transforming it.
Everything is rolling.
When we talk to her, She's in the reading room that she set up for the community in Barbados, which looks out onto the mill of an old sugar plantation.
I'm on a working dairy farm. It was originally a sugar plantation from 1667, so it's impossible for me to move through the day and be separated from the history that this site really holds. Plantations had an employee, an overseer. I'm interested in this idea of inner seeing versus overseeing. Challenging the ledger pages and the colonial project as this objective way of dealing with a place. I do a lot of walking. So when I walk on the soil and I feel it crunching beneath my feet, I'm also looking at it for clues to understand the site. So about 10 years ago, I was reading a will that was written in 1815 by a man called Thomas Applewhite. And Thomas Applewhite owned the place where I live and work, which is called Walker's Dairy. It would have been Walker's Plantation. And I read that Thomas Applewhite referred to Frances as his favorite little girl slave. I can't find her in the archives. She was written about more than anyone else in his will. But I then was taught by a historian that favorite was a code for lover. And it made me think about when I walk on this ground, on this soil, that Frances had walked here 200 years before. And it really made me think about the fact that the soil has memory. And so I often think about Frances when I walk. And when I find the shards in the soil, I wonder whether she held those. And I produced a drawing of her name on 7 ledger pages, these plantation ledger pages with rows and columns, and drew her name out using the fragments of shards that I found in the soil as a way to insist that someone like Frances should be noted in the ledger pages. And I wonder whether listening to the wind come through the trees or just walking on the grass and the soil, is there another way of knowing this place beyond the wills and the deeds and the conveyances?
One thing this really makes me think about is, what can the ledger not contain? What is illegible to the ledger? And this idea of not being found within the ledger, the Frances. On one hand, she recreates Frances through these ledger pages. On the other hand, Frances is not legible to the ledger. It's not recorded there. And actually, in some ways, it's the idea that the ledger should never have had to record her, right? We shouldn't be recorded in ledgers, perhaps. And this idea of a resistance to the ledger. You will never hold me, ledger. I will never be legible to you, ledger. But I am here in the soil, even if you can't see me. What histories are we walking on, over, through? I hear, as Annelied speaks about walking and being part of the practice, and thinking about how important it is for us to understand that the stories of the past are embedded, and every day as we walk, there are things that we are walking on.
This is Georgics by Virgil, book 1, verse 493 to 497. Yes, and a time will come when in those lands the farmer, as he cleaves the soil with his curved plough, will find javelins corroded with rusty mould, or with his heavy hoe will strike empty helmets and marvel at gigantic bones in the upturned graves.
Artist Lauren Galt is based between Glasgow and Macmillan in Northern Ireland. She works in sculpture primarily, sometimes combining film and sound in her installations.
I shapeshift, I suppose, between several guises, one as an artist in a city and the other as a land worker working on a family farm. It's on the east coast in Northern Ireland, in County Antrim, which is very connected to Scotland. And we have cattle and we have sheep and we graze them. So a lot of time is spent looking at grass, thinking about grass, and that by default is thinking about and looking at soil. One of the words that I've been thinking about for quite a long time is the Greek word energeia. It translates roughly as an extreme vividness of the present. In kind of rural or agricultural contexts, the past is quite tangible. You can see it evidenced all around you, and you're constantly thinking about or reaching into the future. The tangible present, I find, is often really ungraspable.
In the summer of 2024, Lauren worked on a project on the Isle of Skye, inspired by the idea of listening to the voices that exist in land. She worked with a series of archaeologists, paleontologists, and classicists to think through our relationship with the soil, starting off with the buckets of minerals that are used to feed cattle.
And I was really interested in the mineral contents of those buckets and what they were doing and what they were saying, really, because the minerals that they hold are absent in our soils and are necessary for healthy animals, healthy crops. So they are a kind of tether to your extension from deep geological time. I happily in parallel was thinking a lot about how land workers, crofters, farmers were often the first people to discover artifacts or objects in the earth because they're the ones who are working the land. So there is an explicit connection between paleontological artifacts and agriculture. In Skye, I was particularly looking at a couple of fossils, one being an ammonite and the other a belemite. And I mean, the belemites were just fascinating. They're like small arrows, so they were viewed as a type of ammunition from another world, or as solid thunderbolts, so you would put them in your roof to ward off thunderstrikes. And also, mineral buckets and the minerals themselves are fossils. You know, there's limestone in them, chalk, and all these natural materials that also have that connection to paleontology. I suppose I really loved that connection to land working, deep time, and the mineral content of the mineral buckets, because they all relate and connect through and with each other.
All relate through and with each other. That's nice. Hearing Lauren speak about her work, I had a phrase that really came to me. Leave it to an artist. Leave it to an artist to find that connection between farming and paleontology. That farmers, because of their close work with the land and the soil, are the first to find the artifacts and the fossils. We need artists to tell those sort of stories. Annalee Davies has also been unearthing deep history from the soil in Barbados.
Soil has been very important through an archaeological project called Unearthing Voices. And we've done about 200 test pits trying to look for the site of an enslaved village in the soil here to be able to tell another kind of story.
One of the challenges is that enslaved villages were not marked on the map. So Annalee and the team are having to guess at where they might have been. And even when they find fragments in the soil, it's hard to know if they have found the exact site.
What I'm finding are like bits of porcelain that you would see, maybe you're familiar with the Chinese kind of willow pattern. Sometimes I'll find a shard that has like a little handle that may be on the top of a sugar bowl. Nails, pipes. But of course, the materials that their homes were made out of were organic, so many of them would have been reabsorbed into the soil, and it's quite difficult to find them. And I was hoping that we could find the site of an enslaved village, not disturb the bodies at all, but just to be able to tell another story and to read it through a different lens, because the archive tends to favour the voice of the white male planter.
I think about Annalee's work as trying to tell another story. The idea of finding pieces of china, finding pieces of ceramic, and then not being able to find other forms of life. Because one is this idea of making concrete a history, and the others, because of finances, because of different ways of living, being a reabsorption back into the soil. Because often you would think about histories as being lost. But when you think about histories being absorbed, I think there is something wonderful about that. That it isn't all about posterity. Maybe the legacy of you is something that is, I was once here, but even if you're not able to find me, I am still here, just in the soil.
My life's work is about unlearning the plantation, which is a model that sits very deep within me. I think that unlearning the plantation really is my life's goal.
So
So to unlearn the plantation is another way of saying to uproot the internalized racism and white supremacy that has been, we've been brainwashed with, really.
When I think about soil, it's not just ancient history, it's living history. Leah Penniman is a farmer and food justice activist. She founded Soulfire Farm in Grafton, New York, a farm that has been doing incredible work with the local community.
You know, I think about Chris Bolden Newsom, who is a Black farmer in Philadelphia, who said the land was the scene of the crime. And I add, she's not the criminal, right? And so the land is the place where chattel slavery and sharecropping and tenant farming and convict leasing and the lynching took place, right? The trees are the ones that they hung our ancestors by. And so it makes really good sense to have run away from those red clays of Georgia and never look back. But I think that what is so insidious about that is by trying to divorce the people who are the color of soil from the soil, the settlers have a double win, right? Because they got all of this unpaid labor, but then they also just take the land and the resources as well. And only in healing that relationship with land and realizing that the oppression that took place on the land is not the land itself, can we reclaim the thousands and thousands and thousands of years before slavery of noble, dignified innovation and connection to land, which is our birthright. You know, in the United States, 98% of the rural land is white owned. The remaining 2% is shared by everybody else who is racialized. So racial justice and ecological justice are inexorably intertwined.
I came to Leah's work through her work, Farming While Black, trying to find practices for growing food and vegetables that connect me to my history and to my culture.
So for us as farmers, soil is the foundation of everything. Soulfire Farm was born in 2010, and we are an Afro-Indigenous-centered community farm and training center with a mission to uproot racism and seed sovereignty in the food system. When we first wed ourselves to this land here at Soulfire Farm back in 2006, it was so eroded and degraded that you could not stick a spade into it. It would clank back. It was hardpan clay and rock. And when our government agricultural agent came by, this person said that the soil was so poor, we would never succeed at growing anything. We should just give up. Of course, we didn't listen. We used our Afro-Indigenous soil building methodologies that we'd learned in Haiti, that we learned in West Africa, in Mexico, and in Oaxaca, and started to build the soil. And when we opened the farm in 2010 and delivered our first vegetables in 2011, they were healthy.
You know what's really, really interesting about Leah's work is that contemporary food trends often reflect Indigenous practices. Leah's work is really important in reflecting and pointing to this repackaging.
Many, if not all, of the organic and regenerative practices that are becoming popularized in our time have some connection to African diasporic wisdom. So for example, on our farm, we use raised beds, rectilinear raised beds. Those can be traced back to the Ovambo people of Namibia, who even under colonization persisted in their ancestral practice to build these rectangular mounds to concentrate fertility. Another example, many people compost, and Indigenous communities all around the world have their own composting systems. And the third example I'll give you for now is Dr. George Washington Carver. He was a Black agronomist in Alabama in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Dr. Carver was teaching people how to cover crop. A cover crop is when you plant crops specifically to feed the soil, not for people to eat. Imagine telling a poor farmer to plant something and then not harvest it. These were wild ideas in the time, but they really saved a lot of farms from collapse.
So putting some of the seedlings into the beds. Try not to disturb the soil too much, just quickly. I wanted to heal my relationship to the land And that really was a work of undoing the relationship of slavery and food growing, thanks to the work of Leah. When you hear a root being ripped up, you're like, oh, there's something so visceral about that. If people can't understand that, like, maybe ripping people from the land that they have known for generations is a bad thing to do, hear the sound of a root being ripped out of the ground, then you'll know.
Being able to work the land feels like a position of total privilege, that I can do that and have access to that. Just land anywhere, it just, there's very evident moments of conflict not far from the Rath site. You know, this is an earthwork that features in the Somerset House work. We found Neolithic axe heads, and throughout history a way to kill the person would be to kill the land by throwing salt on it or doing other sorts of things that feels like it doesn't just kill the present, it kills the past and also the future.
And then there's like the most magical bit of the process, which is where you put your one hand inside the pot and the other hand on the outside of the pot, and from the bottom of the pot you like draw the clay upwards. It's very simple, this gesture, but it feels like the most advanced magic when a pot rises. The reason there's like so many pots in museums is because it has this kind of temporal resilience. These pots are our history. I think one of the most compelling things about working with clay that I find is this way it sort of entangles you in lots of different ways with different ideas of time. Before you fire it, it remains infinitely recyclable, engaged in that geological deep time as this material that can be broken down again until you add heat or fire. And at that moment, there's no going back. That's when you've lifted it out of that deep time and you've lifted it into like a human timeline. You know, you fire it, you add fire, the thing that makes us human. And that is the way we're lifting this material from one timeline into another. Then, you know, it'll be a mug that you drink your cup of tea from every morning. But actually, that mug has a potential life of 20,000 years.
Then I could try and straighten up the walls.
And this is from a riverbed on a little bit of the River Tiddy in Cornwall. And I literally pulled it right out of the bank.
But essentially, this process of taking some clay from the ground and making it into a pot.
It worked!
You're immediately, like, gesturally very, very close to somebody who was around 20,000 years ago. And I find there's something really compelling and really magical. What can it tell me about this process of making with this material?
Wow, I didn't think that clay was ready. It's good. I'm pleased. So that is really tied to place. So my friend's house, it's from my friend's house. And then I've just thrown with it on a wheel. And now it's going to be a cup for them.
As makers who work with soil, you kind of put your hands into time, right? I'm a person working with soil. But the idea of working with clay is formed over time. It's not a material that just exists, you know, it becomes. And this idea, whether you're hand building or throwing, that you are manipulating time in your hands. I need a word for that, shudder. thinking of the earth as a recorder, our human records, you know, our ledgers, our lists, might not show all the aspects, right? So I want to know, what does the land record that the human record doesn't show?
There was a moment that really, really moved me a couple of years ago when a Black soil scientist named Tiffany Lachey came to the farm and did what's called a soil core. So a soil core is when you take a metal cylinder and you twist it down into the ground and pull out a core of soil until you have several meters of history that you can read through the rings and lines of the soil itself. And we get to the top, and there are 12 inches of dark, black, rich humus. And she said, you know, that's you all. You all are the ones who created this topsoil in the decade and a half that you've been here. And in a million years, when a geologist comes and takes a look at the rock striation, you will actually see a line of black where you were here. You will see the contribution that you made to the soil in the geological record. Capitalism will have you measure your gains on a quarterly basis. But a soil scientist or geologist will ask questions that are on geological or millennia timeframe. You know, what is the mark that we make in the record of rock? And so that moment really shifted my life goals. It's like, I want the geological record to show the level of care that our community has had for the earth.
I think what we got wrong about soil was imagining that it was an infinite source, and it is not. So I think that our relationship to soil is maybe something that can teach us about reciprocity and care and nurturing.
The way that we engage with each other as human beings, when it is interdependent, when it is non-extractive, those ethos very easily translate to how we engage with soil and biodiversity.
I think what was always hammered home to me is that everything is, like, the land persists, but what we're doing is very temporary and it does not belong to us in any way, shape or form.
This idea of allowing ourselves to be transformed by the soil, by the land, by the clay, but also seeing the potential for transformation of that relationship to the soil, you know, a less violent one, a more hopeful one, a more careful one. And if we understand that we can pick up a piece of history, we also understand that we are going to become a piece of history. And so what do we want that soil to reflect of us in the future? And Leah, Annalie, Lauren, Jennifer, they really hold up soil as if it was reflective and reflects us as a mirror and says, hey, this is you, but this is also who you can be. The soil will reconfigure even without us, will transform itself. So what part do we want to play in the relationship and the history of the soil?
When I sit out on my patio and I watch the hummingbirds go to the blue vervain, it feeds me so profoundly. That's what soil is offering. It's offering life in very, very basic ways. Yeah, and we need to learn from that.
I'm Shanice Aretha. This episode is produced by Alana Chance. This series is produced by Joe Barrett and Alana Chance for Somerset House. The exec producers are Alana Chance and Eleanor Scott. Original music is by Andrew Peckler. In the next and final episode of Common Ground, we're talking to artists who are inspired by the soil's extraordinary capacity for regeneration and rebirth. Soil, the world at our feet, will be on at Somerset House until the 13th of April, 2025.